From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, Justin Timberlake, who has a new album. He'll tell us about co-starring as a kid in the new Mickey Mouse Club, his great song parodies on Saturday Night Live, and singing with Jimmy Fallon on Late Night. Also, author Nathan Englander tells us about growing up in an Orthodox household with an overprotective mother.
My mother raised me very clearly that if you cross the street, you will die. If you go outside, you will die. If you play sports, you will likely die.
Englander's short story collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, is now out in paperback. Englander also is the translator of a new Haggadah, the story of Exodus that is traditionally read at the Passover Seder. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new action thriller Olympus Has Fallen. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Justin Timberlake, at age 32, is a multimedia star performer. In movies, he's gotten critical acclaim as a dramatic actor, in The Social Network and elsewhere. On television, he's one of the all-time best hosts of Saturday Night Live and has just completed a week of appearances on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. In 2011, he landed on the International Best Dressed list. And in music, where he first made his mark as a singer, he's released a new album called The 2020 Experience. Here's the hit single, Suit and Tie. I can't wait till I get you on the floor good looking. Hey, going hot so hot, just like an oven. And I'll burn myself, but just had to touch it. But it's so fine, and it's all mine. Hey, baby, and we don't mind all the watching. Hi, 'cause if they study close, real close, they might learn something. As long as I got my suit and tie, I'ma leave it all on the floor tonight. And you got fixed up to the nines, let me show you a few things. All dressed up in black and white, and you're dressed in that dress I like. Love is swinging in the air tonight, let me show you a few things. Let me show you a few things. Show you a few things all about love. Now we're in the swing of love, let me show you a few. Justin Timberlake got his first taste of pop stardom as one of the young performers on Disney Channel's The New Mickey Mouse Club, along with Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, and Ryan Gosling. He hit the top of the pop charts as a member of the boy band NSYNC, then went solo as a singer in 2002. He's hosted Saturday Night Live 5 times now. When Terry Gross spoke to Justin Timberlake in 2010, she asked him about one of his memorable appearances on that show, in a music video that soon went viral.
So there's a Saturday Night Live song I want to ask you about, and this song is just so famous now, and I can't really say the full title of the song, but this is this is something that you did with Andy Samberg, and it's a parody of those narcissistic songs and videos in which the male singer thinks that the greatest gift he could give to a lady is his very special lovemaking. So
yes,
this song and video
that
is
was
about,
very eloquently put.
Thank you. This song and video is about presenting his girlfriend. I think it was right before Christmas that you did this. So the song and video is about presenting his girlfriend with his manhood in a gift wrap box. And it's the kind of love song where the singer is singing about how great he is, not how much he loves his girlfriend, but really how much he loves himself.
Right.
And this became one of the most viewed online things. It just went viral. So before we hear it, just tell us about writing this and performing it. It's so much fun. Go ahead.
The weird thing about the couple of things, digital shorts that I've done with Andy and the Lonely Island guys, is that it really, you know, for instance, we wrote the song in a delirium of no sleep on a Wednesday or Thursday of the week, and then we recorded it that night, and we were laughing so hysterically, and like I said before, probably through the delirium of not being able to sleep and trying to write something funny, this came out of it, and we knew that it would be funny on some level because we were laughing with each other on the Friday that we filmed the video, and then Saturday morning they edited it, and Saturday night it was put out on television. So interestingly enough, how you described it, that these guys were so self-absorbed that there could never be a question in their mind that this wasn't the greatest Christmas gift of all time. And
are there just like so many songs performers who seem to be that?
Well, maybe the song is funny to people because it speaks so much to the male population and how self-absorbed we all are.
So you started performing when you were so young. I mean, if you go on the internet, people can see you at age 11 on Star Search singing a country and western
right.
song. So, like, whose idea was it to start performing on TV that young? Was it you? Was it your parents?
As soon as I sort of discovered the stage, I think that it just brought out a lot of a lot in me that I didn't know that I had, and it did it at a very young age, and it was one of the most fun things that I could ever do. You know, I begged my mother for voice lessons and guitar lessons and anything I could do to sort of, I wanted to be really good at it. I wanted to learn how to do it the right way. I knew that I had a good ear in my father, my biological father has an amazing voice and music kind of runs in my family. But I knew that there was a sort of a right way to sing, and I wanted to learn that.
So your grandfather was a Baptist minister, and I think your father now directs a church choir. Was the church your first stage?
It was. It was, actually. It was, well, my father doesn't do that anymore.
Oh, okay.
But he did at the time when I was very young. But yeah, it was the first time I had sort of stepped on stage to sing. And I don't know if you know much about sort of a Southern Baptist church, but no one puts in a bad performance there. You know, it's a very nurturing place to step on the stage and sing, because even if you're really bad, people still say amen at the end. And
so what did you sing?
I can't remember what the songs were. I think there was something from the hymnal that I sang with my father, and I sang the harmony to something that he was singing, and that was my first sort of...
Oh, of course. So you learned to harmonize in the church. That would make sense.
Right. I learned to harmonize listening to a choir sing, you know, 3- and 4-part harmonies, and so that's kind of where I got my ear from. But yeah, like I said, that's a very nurturing place to step on stage, because no one's going to get booed church.
So I watched the clip of you at age 11 on Star Search with Ed McMahon, and some really interesting things about that include that you're singing a country song, and you're dressed in kind of, you know, country clothing with the country kind of belt and the hat, and the dancers
I appreciate you reminding me of all of this.
You're welcome, yes. But, you know, the funny thing, I love, like, kiddie talent shows, because what always happens on those is that the children are coached by older people to perform like performers from older generations. And there's always some, like, really weird disconnect to see, like, a 10-year-old pretending like he's Sammy Davis or something, you know?
A 10-year-old pretending like he's Alan Jackson.
Exactly. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, so
right.
What was that like for you? I mean, to...
Well, it was a very surreal experience. I auditioned for that show at a mall in Memphis, Tennessee, at an open call audition, and I mean, it was a line, you know, at that time, Star Search was our version of American Idol. It was the biggest talent show in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I got booked on the show, and I was at Disney World, and I was 10, and, you know, I mean, it was a big deal for me. And if not for anything, I had a blast at the theme parks. So.
Okay, well, speaking of Disney World, you went on to be on the new Mickey Mouse Club. And what was the audition for that like?
The Disney MGM Studios, where Star Search was filmed, was a double soundstage. And next door to the soundstage of Star Search was the Disney Channel's new MMC. So the serendipity of it is I lost the first round on Star Search, and we were on our way home. And there was an open call audition in Hendersonville, Tennessee. It just came on the television in between commercials, and it said... open call audition at this place for the Disney Channel's MMC, and my mom said, you want to give it a go before we go home? And we're just going home. So I went in and auditioned for it, and then got a call back and went to sort of a casting camp a week period of casting camp where, you know, all the kids who were sort of spawned out of that show, we met for the first time, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and Ryan Gosling, and there were 21 kids who were whittled down by, I think, 20,000 that they had done auditions with all over the country. And out of those 21 kids, I think 7 of us were picked to be the new part of the cast. And when you're a kid and things like that happen, and it happens so fast, you know, you can't help but feel like, you know, something great was happening for you. But I look back on it, and I think it was more of a fluke than anything.
So after a couple of seasons on the Mickey Mouse Club, you ended up being in one of the famous boy bands, NSYNC. Did that feel like a totally synthetic, or did it feel more organic as a group?
Well, everything that we did was based around a cappella harmonies. That's mm-hmm. that's what we wanted to be in the beginning. We sort of wanted to be an a cappella group, and so that was why we put five guys in the group. And when we were forming the group, there wasn't a boy band phenomenon. You know, Nirvana was, and Pearl Jam were probably the top two acts in the world at the time. And you know, we never knew at what capacity everything was going to work out for us. I don't think that we thought it was going to be as big as it became.
Justin Timberlake speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. We'll continue their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2010 interview with performer Justin Timberlake. He's just released his first solo album in 7 years, called The 2020 Experience, and has confirmed that before the year is out, he'll release a companion volume.
You've talked a little bit about singing and learning to sing when you were young. What about dancing? Like, did you study dancing? Did you study with break dancers or with more traditional choreographers?
I wish that I would have taken more, I guess there's still time, but I wish that I would have taken more technical dance. I'd taken a couple of technical dance classes, but I learned more how to dance just as a product of watching MTV and being around, like you said, breakdancers and clubs. I really started getting into breakdancing pretty hard and learning the technicality of it. I broke my thumb twice in a row. And I think that's when I said, you know, I think I'm just going to stay on my feet. I'm going to keep my feet below my head as it's intended.
Were you trying to spin on your head or something when that happened?
Yeah. My head spun me instead of me spinning on my head. It was, wasn't a pretty sight. So I think right then and there I decided that I would sort of, you know, I find that every time I write music or come up with an idea for a record, that whatever it is that I come up with, I feel like I have a specific aesthetic that goes with it, very much like creating a character. I find that I describe that to people, and sometimes they respond to it and sometimes they don't. But for instance, my last album, Future Sex Love Sounds, was a character that I created, much like, you know, obviously not the same way that David Bowie would create something like Ziggy Stardust, you know, but, you know, something that aspired to be a character.
What was the character that you were seeing?
I don't know. I just saw it as someone who I saw, I guess for some reason I saw some mixture between like 007 character, but also an ode to like Fred Astaire. Mm-hmm. In a way, or Gene Kelly. I think I saw it as an ode to that, but how could I take that and make it sound modern? And so when the aesthetic of it came into play, I wanted to play the part. I wanted to play it. But it was, I did feel like I was creating sort of a character that could maybe fall into a Kubrick film or a Helmut Newton photo or... You know, I just saw a lot of images in my mind after we had looked back and created it.
Well, let's take "Sexy Back" as an example. Your voice is processed on part mm-hmm. of that. Why did you want mm-hmm. that?
You know, it was a song. I'm not actually even singing on the song. You know,
what does
I remember
that mean?
When. Well, I'm more sort of talking in tone. More than singing mm-hmm. in that song. And I don't know where that line came from. I sometimes regret it because I feel like people feel like it's an extension of who I am. But when I feel like when I get the opportunity to tell them that I felt like I was playing a character, sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't. you know, for whatever reason, when we started recording it, I wanted the vocal to sort of almost slap you in the face. I wanted it to sound like it was distorted. And so I just got the idea that what if we put it through a simulated guitar amp or an effect like that? It's a very sparse sounding record because there's no in between the parts that I'm actually performing the record, there's just the sound of these weird, quirky, computerized gimmicks. I felt like if anyone ever took dance music and applied a rock and roll frame of mind to it with bravado and sort of rock star-ism, that's what we were trying to capture, and it was just a moment. And I sometimes regret that I wrote it that way, but also not, because it was a moment and it was fun and I had fun writing it. And when I see people sing it back to me, you know, when you cut to me standing on stage in Copenhagen for 80,000 people and they're all singing the song, and there's something so unabashed and fun and unbridled about their feeling with that song. So I felt like it was mission accomplished.
Okay, so after that great description, we have to hear it. This is my guest, Justin Timberlake, singing Sexy Back. I'm bringing sexy back. Yeah. The mother boys don't know how to act. Yeah. I think it's special what's behind your back. So turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Yeah, take a piece of bridge. Dirty babe, you see these shackles, baby, I'm your slave. I'll let you whip me if I misbehave. It's just that no one makes me feel this way.
Take it to the chorus. Come here, girl.
Go ahead, be gone with it.
Come to the back.
Go ahead, be gone with it.
VIP.
Go ahead, be gone with it.
Drinks on me.
Go ahead.
That was Justin Timberlake, recorded in 2006, one of his big solo hits. So that's really fun to listen back to. What was it like for you going solo as opposed to like being in a group? You know, being more having all the responsibility, the main responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, it was comfortable. I think growing up as an only child probably had more to do with that than anything. But I had music that I was ready to express, and I don't think it was an extension of the other guys in the group. And so I think it was a natural progression. There was timing that was involved with some of the other guys aspiring to do other things as well. And so there was a little bit of serendipity to that. But also I think naturally it still would have taken its course that I would have ended up doing solo work just because I think that I had different music inside of me that I wanted to express.
So you are so lucky. You were a child star and survived. I mean, seriously, like the things that you learned as a child star were probably like so helpful in learning, you know, like show business and dancing and singing and acting. But at the same time, it ruins so many people. Like so many people who are lucky enough to have that kind of early fame never recover. So do you have any sense of what it was that has kept you?
I think I would just chalk that up to amazing parents and amazing mother. You know, my
I hope
parents,
she's listening.
I'm almost positive she's listening right now. She's very proud, but I would chalk that up to an amazing mother. She's you know, my biological parents divorced when I was right around the time I turned one, and my mother remarried my stepdad when I was five, and right after I turned 5. And so, you know, there was a period of time where I had to get used to sort of a man that didn't, that wasn't related to me by blood. And you know, she always made everything so comfortable for me, and she always spoke to me like I was her peer. I think the thing that she's sort of embedded in my brain is, if you have the ability to do something, one or two things, great. It doesn't mean that you're a better person than anyone else. And the accolades that I receive personally from what I do are more comments you would get from people that say your music helped them through a rough time, or saying that you made them laugh, rather than, you know, materialistic awards or things like that. But I would chalk it up to a great mother who's always taught me that we all put our pants on one leg at a time. So,
well, Justin Timberlake, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I am such a fan, and I was so excited to be on the show.
I'm very excited to hear you say that.
Justin Timberlake speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. His new album is called The 2020 Experience. Here's an excerpt from one of his appearances last week on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, part 4 of their continuing History of Rap medleys. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Yo, 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 I got you on the check.
Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes the words just hypnotize me. And I just love your flashy ways. I guess it's all the broken, you're so vain.
Holla! Get your freak on. 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 H to the S-O, B to the S-A.
But shizzle my nizzle, use the dribble down to V-A. Yeah.
H to the S-O. That's the anthem, get your damn hands up.
If you wanna go and take a ride with me, with 3 willing and the 4 with the goldie. Woo! So why do I live this way?
Hey, must be the money.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local contractors, dentists, electricians, and mechanics to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And from RDO, a digital music service allowing listeners to discover millions of songs and listen everywhere, RDIO.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Nathan Englander tells us about growing up in an Orthodox family on Long Island and finding the right words to praise God after he became secular. He has a new translation of the Haggadah, the story of the exodus of Jews from Egypt, which is read at the Passover Seder table. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new action film, Olympus Has Fallen. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, writer Nathan Englander, has a collection of stories called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. It's now out in paperback. The stories deal with tensions around Jewish orthodoxy and tradition, arguments about the state of Israel, and what it means to be Jewish in a modern world. Considering Englander's life, it's not surprising these are his subjects. Nathan Englander grew up in an insular Orthodox community on Long Island and attended yeshiva, where he was taught that a second Holocaust, or Spanish Inquisition even, was right around the corner. As an adult, Englander lived for a few years in Israel. It was there that he decided to part with organized religion. But Englander hasn't left Judaism behind. In fact, he spent 2 years translating the Haggadah, the traditional book read at the Seder table during Passover. The new translation, called New American Haggadah, was edited by Jonathan Safran Foer and was published last year. Monday is the first night of Passover. Terry spoke with Nathan Englander last year when his collection of short stories was first published.
Nathan Englander, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the title story of your new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Do you want to set it up or do you want to just start reading?
That's funny. Anytime I set it up, I get metaphysical. It takes about 67 minutes. So, yes. So I don't think you want me to set up anything at all, especially if it's the start of a story, except to say this one is, you know, it's the title story of the book, and it is very terrifyingly to me. But the commitment I made in this story is I married it to Carver's very legendary story, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Okay.
They're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. Mark is looking all stoic and nodding his head. If we had what you have down here in South Florida, he says and trails off. Yup, he says, and he's nodding again. We'd have no troubles at all. You do have what we have, I tell him. All of it. Sun and palm trees, old Jews and oranges, and the worst drivers around. At this point, I say, we've probably got more Israelis than you. Debbie, my wife, she puts a hand on my arm. Her signal that I'm taking a tone or interrupting someone's story, sharing something private, or making an inappropriate joke. That's my cue. And I'm surprised, considering how much I get it, that she ever lets go of my arm. Yes, you've got it all now, Mark says, even terrorists. I look to Lauren. She's the one my wife has the relationship with, the one who should take charge. But Lauren isn't going to give her husband any signal. She and Mark ran off to Israel 20 years ago and turned Hasidic, and neither of them will put a hand on the other in public. Not for this, not to put out a fire.
That's Nathan Englander reading the title story from his new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. I can assure you I've heard that conversation many times.
That's funny.
Have you?
Yes. Yeah. I think that was actually, as someone who spent a lot of years living in Jerusalem, one of the great perks was that when you come back and you get into these Israel arguments in your American Jewish clan, you can really just silence them by saying, I live there. So we used it like a bludgeon. You know, when people would say, like, you know, I'm AIPAC, I'm this, move that, move the, you know, embassy needs to be there. The embassy should have a Starbucks and be on the Temple Mount, whatever. You know, people do that. You'd say, I live there. And that was how we kept everybody quiet.
So another thing that happens in the story, in addition to the disagreements about Israel and about religion, the two couples, the Hasidic couple and the secular couple, play a game that is called the Righteous Gentile Game, or Who Will Hide Me. Will you describe the game?
It's so deeply personal, and it's not a game. And that's the point. I call it a game. It makes it easier to talk about it as a game. But it's something we play with dead seriousness in my family. And that is, you know, we would, you know, wonder who would hide us in the Holocaust if there were a second Holocaust. And I think that's sort of the interest for me, you know, as a, I don't know what to count myself as, a fourth generation or fifth generation. We've been in America a long time. You know what I'm saying? I have great grandparents born here. And that idea that my sister, because of her religious education, were raised in a sense, we have the minds of, you know, like survivors' kids. Anyway, we really were raised with this idea of a looming second Holocaust, and we would play this game. That threat is always in the air. You know what I'm saying? People were comfortable in Berlin. It could happen at any time. And we would play this game, you know, wondering who would hide us. And this story, I've been carrying it in my head for 20 years ago, but I remember my sister said about a couple we knew. She said, he would hide us, and she would turn us in. And it struck me so deeply, and I put it on the neighbors in this story. But I just couldn't shake that thought for all these years because it's true. So I guess in a sense, this is totally it's normality, this game. And I just took a step back and said, my God, we're pathological.
So the impression I'm getting is that, okay, you were brought up in Long Island in a prosperous suburban community, but you're brought up as if a new Holocaust is right around the corner, so start preparing because you're going to be marched off to a death camp unless you find a neighbor or a friend willing to risk their life to hide you. And it's such an embattled mentality, such a paranoid mentality to be carrying around in a prosperous Long Island suburb in what, the 1960s?
I was going to say, I'll make two corrections, which is not so prosperous, but, hanging on to middle class. But, we didn't have FM radio on the car, but we did have AM. But also, the 70s and 80s. I'm born in 1970. I'm a disco kid by a month. But, yes, the 70s and 80s. But you know what? I think it was this strange thing. I mean, it was, I'm living back in Brooklyn, and I was very resistant to doing that. You know, I live up the block from my dad's high school, and my uncle went to school, behind our building at Pratt. You know, there was all these Brooklyn dads, and they made this exodus, and, a lot of them went to public school. They were religious, but they built these yeshivas, and they spent, that's where prosperity comes in. It was this education that I so fought against and so rebelled against and worked so hard to leave was a huge, huge, effort for my parents to give me that education. But but the point is we had these old school rabbis. So I think that's why I write the way I do. I studied with Marilyn Robinson at Iowa. God bless her. She taught me many wonderful things. But one thing she taught me was that I was writing all my sentences in sort of transliterated Yiddish. So, what I'm saying? My mom's, Boston and my dad's from Brooklyn, but I hear everything, I should wait all day here for you to show up 5 minutes late. You know what I'm saying? That's because we went to school. We got there at, 8 in the morning and left at 5. College was easy for us. We were in school a million hours a day with these sort of Brooklyn raised or old country rabbis yelling at us in that rhythm. And I feel like that's the rhythm in my head. So I basically received these messages from the rabbis about what the world will do. My point is, as living as the Holocaust is for me, as an idea of something that just happened and can happen, I feel the same way about the Inquisition. You know what I'm saying? My heart, seriously, I think of the poor rabbi.
I'm laughing.
I was going to say, you have no empathy for the losses of the Inquisition. Obviously, you're a Mel Brooks fan. But
let me just stop you here. So you're brought up with fear that the Holocaust can happen any second.
Yeah.
Maybe the Spanish Inquisition, in which all the Jews from Spain were expelled, changing the whole map of Jews around the world forever and ever. Okay, so how did that affect the rest of your mentality? Did you grow up a worrier, paranoid? Did fear infiltrate other aspects of your life?
I think we can call it a day right now. I've just reached the very core of my soul. I thought it would be a longer interview. But yes, that is, I am constantly in a state of fear. So yeah, you know what I was going to say? It's just between us, so I might as well tell you everything. But but the point is, so this is what I'm getting as an education, is this education of, fear and betrayal and Jewish history, which is not, amplified. It just is. But my mother raised me very clearly that if you cross the street, you will die. If you go outside, you will die. If you play sports, you will likely die. So that's what I was getting at home. But, my point is, I think it may have had a larger imprint on my soul. I don't think other people are worried about it as much. But that story, how we avenged the Blooms in the book, that is a war that we had with the anti-Semites of our town. But that idea of walking down that street, I call it in the story, the chased home from schools. I mean, but those, SWAT stickers, I remember, driving by with my dad and seeing, red SWAT stickers on the sign for, the synagogue or a shaving cream one on our door on Halloween. Those kind of fights and battles and curses. But that had that escalated war with the anti-Semites in our town. It was insane.
Author Nathan Englander speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2012 interview with Nathan Englander, author of the short story collection What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. It's now out in paperback.
So we established that you grew up very Orthodox and in a very like Jewish Orthodox community in Long Island, lived for a few years in Israel, where you became secular. Now, people would probably think it would be the other way around, that you'd go to Israel and become more religious because it is, after all, the Jewish state. So how is it that you ended up becoming secular in Israel?
You know what? I've really been comparing it lately very gingerly but sincerely to friends coming out stories. I think when you grow up in a world and your parents are one way and you're told this is your world, this is how the whole world is, and this is how you're supposed to be, and you are terribly unhappy in that world, it's a very scary thing. And that's, I don't even know why, that the whole time I was so religious and so sincere and so interested in the text, but just felt like this is not the world for me. And it grew, I just thought I will be in this world and I will be unhappy because this is, I'm a good kid. That's what I was supposed to do. I thought this is what I've been given and this is how it's going to be. And I think when I'd meet a Jew who was totally unaffiliated, to me, there was no such thing as being a cultural Jew. So that idea, I just didn't connect. I wouldn't meet someone who said, oh, yeah, my mom's Jewish, or, I think, we did Purim one year. Like, there was no leap that I could make that I could connect and say, here is a path, this is a world that I can connect with. And when I got to Israel and see these people, living in Hebrew, living that life, to me, it was the first time I saw Jews who were so, who had the biblical references, all this stuff, deeply secular, atheistic Jews who I could identify with. And I mean, the first week there is when I gave up organized religion. Like my first Shabbat in Israel is I broke it after, 19 years.
Now, you've also written a new translation of the Haggadah. And why don't you explain what the Haggadah is?
Yeah, the Haggadah is it's the story of Exodus, and every year on Passover, when we all know the Red Sea getting split and the 10 plagues and all that stuff. It's as Jonathan Foer, who is the editor of it, keeps saying, thinks it's probably the most popular story around. But yes, so it's a way to commemorate the Jews, freedom from slavery.
And it's basically a book that is read during the Passover Seder, the dinner, or it's read
right
before the dinner. Dinner's very late.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the Jews like to eat, if your audience doesn't know that, and it is the dinner with the biggest buildup of the year.
So you have a new translation, and the book is called The New American Haggadah.
Yes.
The editor is Jonathan Safran Foer, who I think initiated the project. You did the translation,
yes.
And I'm sure our listeners who heard the beginning of this interview are thinking, well, why did they choose this guy? This guy used to be Orthodox, then he became really secular. He rebelled against religion. So who is he to be translating a very important religious text? So why you?
I have to say Jonathan's, he just had a vision for this book and he really wanted me to translate it. And he just made it clear that it would be something that we'd really be proud of at the end. He was really adamant about that. And I have to say, it's informed my writing. It's changed the way I think. And having the book here, I'm really thankful for it. And it ended up being, I thought it'd be this hipster Haggadah and take me 6 weeks. I have been working on it for 3 years.
And what was your ambition? What did you think needed changing? I mean, why do we need a new Haggadah?
It's sort of, I think, of all the traditional Jewish documents, it's the one that's most living. People, there's a Armed Forces Haggadah and an Alcoholics Anonymous Haggadah and an LGBT Haggadah. There are Haggadahs for everything. Some families make them new every year. It's a really wonderful living document. And, even Jonathan's choice of the New American Haggadah, they're always of a place. A very legendary one is the Sarajevo Haggadah. They're just constantly made throughout time. And he felt it was time for a new one. But about what made the decision for me to translate it, what committed me to it is that back to loving texts, which is the Haggadah, you should read it and weep. It is so beautiful. It is just such a moving document to me. And the line I can tell you is that really clinched it for me is in Hebrew, it says, Lavdil bein kodesh lekodesh. And in English, it was translated, which is what it means, to differentiate between the Sabbath and the holiday. But in Hebrew, what it says is, to differentiate between holy and holy. And I was like, someone made this decision to for clarity and understanding. It means between these 2 days. But to me, the poetry, the metaphysical space, the space between holy and holy, for that to not be there in the English was just, it made me understand that I wanted to do, you know, it turned it from this, what I thought would be a 6-week project into me working with a study partner head to head. It's called Chavruta style, face to face. We studied for 3 years.
Now, you use the term in your translation in referring to God, to King of the Cosmos. Now, I can't say that I remember hearing the word cosmos in any services or prayers, but it seems to me an interesting choice. I think I've heard like King of the Universe, but cosmos? So tell us about using the word cosmos.
You are such a generous reader, as I know both as a listener, but here I am. But thank you. You know what? It's been so long, it just becomes part of you, these projects, but I guess I hadn't thought about it. Those choices were the most wrestled over. You know, it's maybe that one, and also God of Us for Eloheinu. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always our God. So it's this idea, I think, back to language, that things we don't hear anymore. You know, it's something like friendly fire or something, these things that are very loaded and they have meaning, and you know the meaning. That's how we get through life in a speedy fashion. You know, words have meanings and we already have them at the ready and we move through them. And I thought, people say these things in English and I think they're forgetting what they're saying. And it means the world to me that you ask that question, because that's the point. You know, because you'd say universe, you read past it. But that's what it's saying, you know, of the cosmos, and it makes you think, and that's it. And that was really it. I think maybe the most dangerous choice in the whole book was God of Us instead of our God. Because we say our God, it's not our God that we own, like our God, our TiVo, our lunchbox. You know what I'm saying? Our God means the God over us. And I really thought about that a ton. And I think that's, you know, I'll see how people respond. But to me, I suddenly thought, my God, people are going to be praying from this, I better think.
One of the times you use King of the Cosmos, I'm going to do the larger reading there. It's like, you are blessed, Lord God of us, King of the Cosmos, God, our Father, our King, our Majesty, our Creator, our Redeemer, our Shepherd, Shepherd of Israel, the good King who makes good for all. You know, when you read something like that, when I read something like that, part of me wonders, does God need to be praised that much? Why is there so much praise for God? Is it just a kind of thanksgiving for life, thanksgiving for, you know, whatever it is, that animating force that we call God? Or is God like this egotist and we need to say, hey, man, you're number one. You are great. You are the God of all. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I was going to say, I'm going to answer that question for you now, but I'm sure you'll get a bunch of emails answering it for you. I guess this is the point of also, you know, of doing a translation of what you hear in Hebrew. Exactly that. It's not, that's the point of wanting to make it sound the way it sounds in my head, which to me is very beautiful, right? There can be over-cloying thanks. You know, that's what we, right? Nobody wants that. Nobody even enjoys it when they get it. It's often just acknowledging a power structure. I know what you're saying, where you're like, thank, you know, someone gives you a job. Oh, thank you. You saved my life. This is the, you know, it's over the top. And trust me, I'm an over the top thanker. So I know what you're, I know what you're saying. But I guess I find this, you know what? This is about freedom from slavery. This is about getting your homeland that was, you know, promised you. This is about return. It is a deeply sincere text. I think it is truly thanking God for the food that we are eating, for the freedom that we have, for the, you know, family around us. I you know what I can tell you? This is so personal and will, you know, probably make my family cry. But, you know, I remember my brother-in-law, as I said, I'm like fourth or fifth generation. And sitting there, my sister's husband, you know, his father's an Auschwitz survivor. And, you know, and sitting there with him, I remember one Seder with his family. I don't know if they'll remember it, but this is when we all became one family. But sitting there, this is also probably, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, but all of us sitting together and just seeing this guy, that's what makes it a living document. He sat there and he looked at the table and he started to cry and he said, I have been a slave. And I thought about it. I said, this man was in Auschwitz. I don't know if I've ever met. He literally had been a slave. And that freedom, there's a lot of thanks for survival and freedom that goes into that.
Well, Nathan Englander, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Author Nathan Englander speaking to Terry Gross last year. His collection of short stories, called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, is now out in paperback. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Olympus Has Fallen, a new action movie that takes aim at the White House. This is Fresh Air. The White House is seized by terrorists in the new action thriller Olympus Has Fallen. It stars Gerard Butler, Morgan Freeman, Angela Bassett, and, as the hostage president of the United States, Aaron Eckhart. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
What surprises me about the ongoing discussion of violence in cinema and whether it influences violence in the real world is how people fail to engage with the male fantasy behind these films. There's a template for them, a theme. It hinges on violation and vengeance. A seminal action picture of the last 50 years is 1988's Die Hard, in which a lone male cop operates behind the scenes after an ingeniously orchestrated foreign attack on American soil. He's symbolically emasculated. He has no gun or even shoes. His wife is now going by her maiden name. Arrogant bureaucrats from the city and FBI castigate him for breaking protocol. But he's an all-American hero. And so is Mike Banning, the fallen Secret Service agent of this year's die-hardish vigilante fantasy, Olympus Has Fallen. The picture is vile, but it hits its marks harder than anything I can remember, and it works. It makes you sick with suspense on the most primitive level imaginable. In the opening, Banning, who's played by Gerard Butler, makes a split-second decision to save the life of the president, played by Aaron Eckhart, but at the expense of the First Lady. It's the right call, but not protecting one's women is a big stigma in this kind of movie. Banning takes a job outside the White House so as not to remind POTUS and his son of the loss. But then comes the hideous violation. During a presidential meeting with South Korean diplomats, some kind of souped-up hovercraft invades D.C. airspace, riddling people with bullets. Half the Washington Monument crumbles, symbolic on several different levels. Olympus, Secret Service code for the White House, falls. Terrorists shoot almost everyone, except for Banning, who drives like mad to the scene, dodges bullets, and gets inside, alone but on his game. Director Antoine Fuqua made Training Day and other films that made a pretense of using violence as more than a means to work you over. But the carnage here is both cruel and crude. Waves of people go down in showers of gore. The audience is primed to cheer when a pretty Asian terrorist gets her head blown off. The Stars and Stripes is shot full of holes and torn down. It drifts to the ground in slow motion. Waiting for word is what's left of the government, including Angela Bassett as the Secret Service director and Morgan Freeman as the Speaker of the House turned acting president, a job he practiced for as the president in Deep Impact. That's when they hear from our hero.
We have contact from inside the White House. Trace confirms it's the president's sat phone.
Put it through. Mr. President?
Negative.
Identify yourself.
Echelon 4.
It's one of yours?
Designator.
Oscar Zulu, 309er.
Jesus, Banning? Where are you?
In the Oval Office. There's a president in the bunker. Can we trust him?
Banning was one of our best agents.
Mr. Speaker, I just have to say, this is Mike Banning. Is this the same guy that was removed from the president's detail after the accident
right,
when we lost the first lady?
Well, what's you want to add in the White House? I suggest right you get
how
your
how
back
do we know
straight.
We can trust this guy?
Banning is ex-Special Forces, Ranger Battalion. He will move mountains or die trying. I know him.
Does anyone else in this room have any intelligence coming out of the White House? And we have no choice.
He will move mountains or die trying. Well, he doesn't move mountains, but he shoots, stabs, strangles, and tortures bad guys. And though Gerard Butler doesn't have much personality, he's solid, by which I mean he carries himself well and he's all muscle. The terrorists are led by a North Korean psychopath who mouths leftist-sounding slogans. He's aided by an assemblage of Asians, Middle Easterners, and people of darker hues, plus a turncoat agent played by Dylan McDermott. What we Americans, personified by Banning, do best is defend ourselves, in one case using a bust of Lincoln to bust a foreign terrorist's head. Okay, lots of not-sick people enjoy violent junk like Olympus Has Fallen, including, on occasion, moi. I'm just tired of these tropes and their sway over large segments of the populace. Sure, we face threats, but the disproportionate number of movie scenarios like this, violation and vengeance, suggests a kind of addiction. I don't know what it means, but I know these aren't movies, really. Their fixes.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Candida Fund, supporting the National Parks Conservation Association, working to ensure that America's national parks are well-funded and well-managed. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from the Orfala Foundation, working to strengthen communities by empowering individuals at orfalafoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ty Burr, author of Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. One of its subjects is what movie studios did to turn actors into stars. When Johnny Weissmuller was starring in the Tarzan movies, MGM paid off his wife to divorce him.
MGM wanted to promote him as a single guy, because for him to be married would have killed the fantasy.
Join us.